Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care, with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. So this week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we headed to Bloomington, Indiana to check in with two of Indiana's James Beard Award semifinalist chefs. We'll be talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington about his career and where it's taken him. From Columbus, Indiana to Paris and New York City and the Caribbean before he came home to Indiana to launch Farm Bloomington. And we'll also talk with David Talent, chef owner at Restaurant Talent in Bloomington and a longtime James Beard Award semifinalist. We'll hear about his reaction to making that semifinalist list for the first time and the ninth time. And we'll also hear about how Restaurant Talent has changed over the years and what's ahead for the popular Bloomington restaurant. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, you get to listen in on what some of our top culinary talent are up to and meet some of our farmers, food artisans, and other members of the local food community. But you also get to hear what I'm up to and obsessing about, whether that's checking out as many farmers markets as I can in a week, like I did last summer, or whether it's learning how to bake a souffle, which I've been trying to do recently, and I'm sure I'll have more on my souffle progress in the coming weeks. But what I've been focusing on this past week are the James Beard Foundation Restaurant and Chef Awards, specifically the semifinalist list for the awards that was announced this past Wednesday. Now, I'm among the 400 or so writers, educators, and former award winners who vote on the awards, and I never know until the list is announced which chefs have made the cut, and I'm always excited to see Indiana chefs make it onto the list. This year, we have two chefs on the list from Indianapolis, Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4, and Micah Frank of Black Market. And we also have two from Bloomington, Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington, and David Talent of Restaurant Talent. Now that lineup is interesting because David Talent has been on the semifinalist list, often called the long list, for 9 years now. In fact, he was on the long list before it was even called the long list. Now, this is Greg Hardesty's fourth time on that semifinalist list, and it's the first time for Daniel Orr and Micah Frank. So it's a very interesting collection of chefs on the list. So it's very exciting this year, I think. Now, several other chefs have been on that semifinalist list in the past. Our Bistro's Regina Mihalik, The Libertine's Neil Brown, Stephen Oakley of Oakley's Bistro. But no one has made it onto the short list of finalists, the actual nominees for the award. That's what I'm hoping for this year, that one of our chefs will make that short list. Now, that list is announced in March, and then the James Beard Awards Gala is in May, and that's a party, with great food and some of the best people watching. I was kind of playing Spot the Famous Chef when I attended. Now, that time I did spot a food celebrity with ties to Indianapolis, Ted Allen, who grew up in Carmel, took home some media awards that year as host of Food Network's Chopped. I even snapped a photo of him on the red carpet before the event. And I have to admit, I took a few photos of famous chefs that night, and more than a few of the food, which was amazing. But I'm hoping to do even more of that at this year's awards. Only this year, I hope I'll be spotting and photographing one of our Indiana chefs. Columbus native Daniel Orr left Indiana in the early 80s for culinary school on the East Coast, traveled in Europe, became a New York City chef, and at age 34 earned a 3-star review from the New York Times. But his career eventually brought him back to Indiana, Now he's on the James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards semi-finalist list for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region. So I stopped in at Farm Bloomington recently to catch up with him. Tell me a little bit about your progression.
Well, it was quite a long story, but I'll try to make it brief. When I graduated from high school, I'd already been cooking in restaurants and had been an assistant chef to Cummins Diesel Engine Company's corporate chef, as well as to Christine Limley, who ran the Walnut Room in Columbus, Indiana, which was, you know, a restaurant that was way ahead of its time, wonderful place. And so I decided I did want to cook, and so those were my summer jobs when I was in high school, and went to Johnson & Wales in Providence, Rhode Island, and was there for 2 years in the culinary program, and then became a teaching assistant and fellowship instructor, and finished my second 2 years of hotel restaurant management, back in the days when we didn't have POS systems and computers, and everything was done by hand, so, you know, I'm still trying to catch up with that. And from Providence, I went down and worked on World Yacht Enterprises, which are, they call it Elegant Dining Afloat, and these are, there are four big boats that went around the Statue of Liberty and up the East River, and we were there for the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty, so we had Bob Hope on the boat doing comedy shows, and, you know, I ran one of those boats, and we've served about 500 people at a time, so that was kind of a big deal, learning how to cook for large groups like that.
Now, how was that coming from Columbus, Indiana, and then moving away and doing stuff like that? Was that was it kind of a shock, or were you happy to be there and happy to be out of the small town, or what?
Well, back in that time, there weren't celebrity chefs. You know, you followed your passion. I loved what I'm doing. You know, probably parents at that time would be a little bit disappointed that their son became a chef, their son or daughter became a chef, because they'd rather have them be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, whatever that is. But today it's much different. So, I mean, I was kind of blazing my own trail at that time. And, you know, I'm 51 going on 52 now. So that was 20-some years ago, 25 years ago, more than that. I wanted to get out of the small town. You know, was exposed to things even back at that time. In southern Indiana, I'd had truffles, I'd had foie gras, I'd had lobsters, I'd had good Bordeaux wines, you know, working for Mr. Miller and Jim Gregory and Claire Gregory at the Cummins Diesel Company. So I'd had those good things, and I wanted more of them. And so that's why I wanted to get out of Columbus, Indiana. But then, you know, all those years later, I came back and kind of, you know, found my inner Hoosier and you know, felt very nostalgic for the Midwest, and so moved back. But between then, before that happened, I went to Rye, New York, and worked for a restaurant called La Panettiere, which Jacques Loupiac is the owner, and I became the executive chef there, tragically, when the head chef got killed in a car accident. And I was the second-in-command, got moved in. I was the first American chef there, and he always told me...
Now, how old were you at that time?
That would be about 3 years after college. So that would be 21, 22.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I took over, but the owner, Jacques, always would say, Daniel, that's not the way we do it in France. Daniel, that's not the way we do it in Paris. I'm like, okay, I've got to get out of here and learn how they do it in France, because I don't want anyone to ever say that again. And back then, it was all about French cooking. I mean, if you were in a high-end restaurant, it was a French restaurant. You know, nowadays we have cuisines from all over the world, and we have, you know, much more regional and local cuisine happening, and people getting back to, you know, the farm and fork kind of movement and local ingredients and old recipes from their region. But back then, if you were going to work in a fine restaurant, it had to be a French restaurant. So from there, I went to France, and I went for about 2.5 years, worked in 7 restaurants in France and Belgium.
Oh, that's a lot. Did you just get you had places you wanted to go particularly, or things you really wanted to learn particularly?
Well, before I went there, I had been buying foie gras and duck and magret canard from Ariane Daguin, whose father owned a 2-star restaurant in Auch, in the southwest of France near Toulouse, and he also ran the restaurant under the pyramid in the Louvre. So she got me set up to go work for him, and I worked in Paris. I worked under the Louvre, and, you know, it was amazing. And then he invited me to go down to his main restaurant, and which had 2 stars, and he was the one who really started. They called him the King of Foie Gras, and he was the one who started serving duck breast rare, medium rare. Before that, was always well done, you know, the old classic duck à l'orange, you know, this old kind of classic cuisine. And he was the one that really, and he, to get local people to order it, he told them it was steak, and because they would not eat the duck rare. And so anyhow, I worked for him, and then he passed me on. And, you know, it's kind of like being passed on from chef to chef, and I worked about 2 to 3 months in each place. I worked at L'Espérance in Vézelay for Marc Monod, who was the chef of the astronauts, the French astronauts. And I worked in Brussels at Chez Bruno, which is a 3-macaroon Michelin restaurant. And worked different places in between and did little stages. And, you know, it was just a great – and I didn't speak any French when I went there.
Oh, my gosh. Really? You didn't take no high school French or anything like that? No.
You know, they say the best way to learn a foreign language is on the pillow. But in the kitchen is almost as good. So if you can combine the two, that's even better.
Right. So what was it like being a young kid in France and learning and tasting and cooking? Was that very – that must have been very cool.
Well, it was. I mean – back then, I mean, French culinary system is a brigade system, which is very militaristic, and, you know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up, and they generally treat people fairly harshly.
So it was pretty tough, right?
But I was already a chef, and I was from America, and they all wanted to come to America, and so they treated me better. And I actually even got to sometimes come up with some specials and, you know, I got to really know the owners of the restaurants probably better than their own employees would. So they, you know, would invite me to their homes for holidays. And I remember, you know, Mr. Daguin inviting me to a luncheon in Provence at his cousin's house, where we were having lunch underneath the fig tree with this baked cod dish with potatoes and all the local ingredients. And so that was a really, really great experience.
We've been talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio for more from one of Indiana's top chefs. We are back with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington to hear more about how a kid from Columbus cooks his way around France and comes home and heads to New York City.
So, after France, okay... fast forward, I got back to America. I'd never been to a lot of America, so I'd traveled through 15 countries in Europe while I was over there. I had a Eurail pass, and you know, ate all over Europe. There was a little bit more of a Iron Curtain back then, but I did get into Budapest and some areas like that. But when I got back, I realized I hadn't been to America really, and so I got in the back of my truck, I put a cab on it, and drove from Indiana to Seattle and then down the whole coast and zigzagged back and forth and went to every state I'd never been to.
What was that like? Wow, that's something.
Well, do you know Jane and Michael Stern, Road Food? Well, I took their book, and I went off the main highways, and I just followed their recommendations for regional American cuisine, and that's what I did. I just followed their kind of guide and, you know, really had a wonderful time and slept in KOA campgrounds. And if I needed a shower, I might stay in a hotel for a night. But I remember waking up, you know, parked right on the beach in California and seeing the sunrise and seeing, you know, large elk or some kind of animal on the beach. And it was just, you know, it was great. Did it all by myself, was my, you know, own best friend. And, it, you know, it took me, I think, about 2 months, 2.5 months. And on the way back, I was driving through Memphis and called my mother. And she said, someone called you from New York, and they want you to work in Manhattan.
Oh, my gosh, how cool is that?
So I guess Charles Masson, who owned La Grenouille in New York, called. He had talked to people in France, and they had said, well, there was this young American chef, and his name is Daniel Orr, and, you know, if you're looking for someone, you know, that might be a good fit. So I became the first American chef at La Grenouille, which was opened the year before I was born. So it's the grand dame of French restaurants. It's still around, although the patriarch just died this year. And, you know, I learned so much from her. She was one of my biggest mentors. She had this wonderful manor house in Brittany, and she invited me to come there and stay with her because we were closed for a whole month every summer, and you know, which doesn't happen anymore. But back in the day, I think they stopped that about 10 or 15 years ago. But a lot of the big restaurants closed down for the month of August because before there was all the air conditioning and everything else, it was too hot. All the rich people went to the Hamptons or to the Catskills or to upstate New York. And, you know, the men would stay in town, and the women and the families would go out to the shores. So anyhow, she invited me over to France, and I got to go back there. And just, you know, it was amazing. I spent 7 years under her tutelage. And from there, Sir Terence Conran from London, who owned the Conran shops and the Conran restaurant empire, which was about 30 restaurants all over Europe. He's since retired to his manor house. But you can go online and find, he's got great design books and great cookbooks. And so his first restaurant in New York or in America was Guastavinos, which was under the Queensborough Bridge. And the bottom of the bridge, the actual tile work, which is Guastavino tiles, was the roof of the restaurant. So it had about a 70-foot high ceiling at the highest parts. It was about 500 seats in the restaurant.
Now, what year was this?
That was the year before 9/11. So we were open. It was a $20 million operation that it cost to open that thing, and we brought in over $20 million the first year.
Now,
that's
not
profit,
right?
Sales. But then after 9/11 hit, it just really. I mean, we were under a bridge that carried all the power from Queens over to the Upper East Side. So it was considered a terrorist target. So, you know, things kind of changed there. We had to start doing more nightclub style stuff just to get bodies in there. And I decided I didn't like that much anymore. I was the executive chef. You know, when we opened, I had hired about 80 cooks, between 80 and 100 back of the house people. And my friend Lee Rizzuto, who owns Cuisinart Brand and Conair and Waring, he has a resort in Anguilla. And he said, Daniel, why don't you come down and you know, run my operation. I've lost my French chef, and I want to see what you can do. So I went down to Anguilla for 2 years, and that's where I wrote Paradise Kitchen, the cookbook.
Now tell me a little bit about that, about deciding to go down there to the Caribbean, right? You know, after 9/11, you know, did you want a change? You know, was it, why go down there and do that?
Well, I did want a change. I had, you know, basically I owned a penthouse apartment on 42nd Street, and I could see the towers from my rooftop garden. And I got a phone call that morning and was told that, you know, the towers had, one of the towers had gotten hit, and I went up and watched the whole thing happen. I had friends that, you know, were covered in dust and came and stayed with me. And, you know, the pressure and the stress and the, you know, sadness was really tough. And so that's one of the reasons I did want to get out of town and, you know, try something different. And it was a great experience.
Was it?
Really, really loved it. You know, Anguilla is an island about 14 miles long and 3 miles wide, which is about the same size as Manhattan. But in Anguilla, there are 11,000 people on the island. And in Manhattan and the, you know, surrounding areas, there's 11 million. So, you know, it's a little bit different. I remember when I came back from Anguilla, being up in my apartment, looking down at all these little ants running around on the sidewalk, which were really people, and not really being able to interact, whereas in the islands, you know, I was stopped on the way to work by someone waving their hand, wanting to talk to me, or, you know, a herd of goats or something like that. So when I came back to America, I sold my apartment and came back to Indiana and opened Farm Bloomington.
We've been talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington about the twists and turns of his culinary career. We'll be back with more about what the chef has planned for the future after this. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana, was recently named to the James Beard Awards semifinalist list for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region. We've been talking with the chef about where his career has taken him in the past and what he's focused on now. Part of that, you were coming back, you know, your father was ill at the time, and so, you know, you were coming back to help with that too, right?
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of things that kind of, you know, influenced the decision. At the time, I remember Mario Batali, I was talking to him, and he was saying that his new restaurant was going to cost $11 million to open up or something like that. And I just didn't want to get that involved financially in anything. Of course, he had, you know, lots of investors, and I had three or four restaurants at the time. But I didn't want to get involved in that kind of a financial situation. And, you know, I have family and friends back here that were encouraging me to come back. And, you know, it was nice to spend the last 5 years of my dad's life with him. And, you know, get my mom started on her next page of her program, and so she's down, you know, really working on our permaculture organic farm, and, you know, working with our farmers down there, and, you know, she's built kind of a wonderful little retreat down there that that she can spend a lot of time. She's hands-on down there on the farm, and the 10-year plan is to do a distillery down there with our own fruit brandies. So we're going to try to get the trees planted this year, and then maybe in 10 years, we'll have the fruit.
So now, Farm Bloomington, Bloomington, Indiana. You opened this really terrific, kind of fun, kind of kitschy place. It's not fine dining. It's not French at all. So tell me a little bit about opening Farm and what you envisioned and how it all turned out.
Well, one of the things that I learned when I was in Anguilla was a lot more about actual farming and gardening. On the resort, at Cuisinart Resort and Spa, we had a hydroponic farm, and Dr. Howard Resch was the hydroponic farmer there, and he's one of the leading hydroponic people in the world, and you can go online and look him up. He's amazing. So we had tomatoes and green beans and peppers and lettuces and herbs and cherry tomatoes and everything growing in this interior hydroponic farm. I really worked on a program where we were composting all the waste from the kitchens and trying to make it, was, you know, an arable farm work in the islands where it's mostly sand. Some of those islands are really fertile and beautiful and lush, and that, you know, most of those are volcanic islands, where Anguilla is a reef island. It's actually it's from a natural reef. So we had to really build that soil with our own organic compost, and, you know, it just also got me on to Living Green, and that's what we do at Farm as well. You know, we recycle, we use, you know, all of our to-go containers are made out of plant products. Even our straws and our to-go silverware are compostable. And, you know, so that really got me on that program. And so at Farm Bloomington now, we've settled into kind of a routine after 7 years. And, you know, we've got our Burns dinner, which is our Scottish dinner in January, and Valentine's Day, and then Chinese New Year's, and Mardi Gras in February, and it just kind of goes on and on. Big time of the year is our graduation for IU, and that is just every year it's a hellish, like being hazed in a fraternity every year. But it does get a little bit easier. It never gets easy, though. But, you know, I'm able to kind of step back a little bit now. I've got a wonderful head chef named Bob Adkins who helped me open the restaurant, and now he's come back. He worked at The Rail, which was a wonderful kind of late-night cocktail and tapas bar, which unfortunately had shuttered. But now he's back here, which is awesome for me. So that means I get to take vacations and do things again.
Well, now tell me what your vision was for Farm when you opened it, and how you were, you know, what it was like coming back to Indiana.
Well, I mean, my idea was to have fun, a place where people could congregate, all people in different socioeconomic spheres of Bloomington, everyone from, you know, college kids or a kid going to Ivy Tech to, you know, the Cook's executives and tenured professors at IU. But that's what's fun about Bloomington is that you have that, you know, really fun, artistic group of people, and you've got great music, great arts. So I wanted to kind of create the same feeling in the restaurant, bringing in the kind of natural colors, the old nostalgic colors of a farm, and a lot of those old tools and different things that you'd find around a farm or in rural areas, but then have that kind of cutting edge lighting and music and feel that you would have in Soho and in New York. So that's where it's kind of Hoosier meets Soho kind of feel to it. And then downstairs we have the Root Cellar Lounge, and that place is just kicks all night. You know, there's some nights where first person gets into the restaurant at 6:30 in the morning, and the last piece person leaves the restaurant at 5:30 the next morning. So, you know, on a Saturday or Sunday, that's usually how it is here.
Well, now describe the food and what the focus of that is here.
Well, when I was working in Anguilla and even in New York, I was always very interested in using local ingredients, foraged ingredients, things that you may not find everywhere else. Some people call them weeds, but I love these real natural, and they're also very, very good for you ingredients that have a lot more antioxidants than a head of iceberg lettuce. You know, you get lamb's quarter and you get these other different greens. I love that stuff. But we also support a lot of local farmers, but we're not strictly a farm-to-fork restaurant. You know, we do cater to the IU students. We you know, we have pizzas and burgers, and we always try to do some kind of a local twist on it. We use the local bison in our bison burger, and the scholars in everything buns, and the pizzas often have, especially during the growing season, a lot of great ingredients. All of our pork and our chicken for the dinner menu, and our eggs, cheeses, even some of our fish. We're getting locally raised, farm-raised trouts. We've gotten local farm-raised shrimp here as well. So we really try to utilize as many local ingredients, support the local food economy as much as possible. And then we also grow things on our own farm down in Princeton, Indiana. And we'll be doing a lot more of that this year now that we have some full-time farmers there.
Now, tell me a little bit about that. That's been kind of a long-time vision sort of thing, right?
Well, it was my grandpa's vision, so yeah, it's been a very, very long-time vision. And my mom has really kind of inspired a lot of that. It was her dream to have her daddy's farm become productive again. You know, we have the big fields that have the corn, soybeans, winter wheat, all that stuff growing on them. But 64 acres of it, we've bought back from our family's partnership, and my mom, my brother, and I started Kolb Homestead, K-O-L-B Homestead. You can go online and look it up. And we've got a great young farm family, ex-military guy, who's and he's married to a Native American woman. And they've got four kids, and the place just seems alive now that we have a family living on it. We've got little kids running around. We're going to start a flock of geese this year. We're getting some puppies to train to learn to run the geese and take care of them. We are going to get some other livestock, and we're really going to start on the gardening. And then this fall we'll be putting in, we're going to be prepping the soil all summer to put in the fruit trees and the bushes. And then that's, we have one area of the farm called the Fruit Bowl, and it has a different kind of geothermal thing going on there where it sits in a valley and the cold air blows over it instead of up into it. So we can grow things there that you couldn't grow anywhere else in southern Indiana. So it will be very exciting to see how that comes, and we're working with some really great permaculture people that are Peter and Keith that are helping us plan all that and really get a big picture going on what Kolb hopes that can be. But there are five historic barns, all built right around 1900, as well as a brick eye house, which was built in the 1860s. And that's on the National Historic Landmark. And so we really want to make it an agritourism kind of place. I have dreams of either a bed and breakfast or a gourmet campground where people could actually come and camp and then work in the gardens and cook with chefs and stuff like that and have a kind of a family thing. So we'll see. That's a 10-year plan. Right now I'm just focused on farm.
We've been talking this morning with Daniel Orr, chef owner at Farm Bloomington Restaurant. You can look for his cookbooks, Paradise Kitchen and Farm Food, and can find out more about him at farm-bloomington.com. Chef David Talent of Restaurant Talent in Bloomington is certainly one of Indiana's top chefs. The restaurant he has run for 11 years with his wife, Kristen, is among the best in the state. In fact, he has been on the semi-finalist list for the James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards 9 times now. I stopped in this past week to catch up with Dave and hear about what it's like to find yourself on a James Beard Award list for the very first time. Tell me a little bit about the very first time.
I mean, it's definitely something that I never expected, and I'm pretty sure it might have been you that called and asked me about it, and I was completely clueless that.
Oh my goodness.
At that point in time, and it was a complete shock, and it was being a lot younger. It was kind of a big deal.
Now, how old were you then?
32 or 33.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I mean it was and we were a year or two into opening this restaurant and everything that goes along with that, and so it was like, whoa, really? how do they know about what's going on? Because at that point I really didn't have a lot of understanding about how the process worked and all of that. So it was cool, because that was also too when Michael Simon was on that list and Paul Kahn was still on that list, and it's like that I was on one of the 20 on a list with guys like that was just kind of blew my mind.
And again, that was when the region was bigger.
Yes.
Right? So it took in a lot, right?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, I think it was Indiana and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Illinois, and I think it might have even been Minnesota too. So I think it was this whole Great Lakes Midwest region that and not the whatever four states or whatever it is now. So it was a really huge shock.
So how has it come along since then? Is it because this is the 9th time, I think, if I've counted up right?
I think so.
So how is it? Is it still fun every year?
Yeah, no. It's still fun to find out, and to know, and I think. There's maybe only been one or two years where I actually, was counting down the minutes to look and see, and most of the time I just, I'm caught up in something else, and I get a text message from somebody or, an alert that someone has, posted on Twitter or something like that, and I'm like, oh, okay, I forgot it was today, or I didn't know it was today, every time is great.
Yeah. Now, have you thought about what it might be like, to be on that short list and be there at the gala cooking or whatever it is the chefs have to do?
I'd be lying if I said I hadn't, but, I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's all that realistic at this point, but, the way as I've gotten older and the way I look at it now is if me being on this list however many times, whatever, brings more attention to, we have a lot of really great young cooks in the state, and especially in Indianapolis, that, if we can start to shine some light on these guys, then, bringing people to Indianapolis and bringing people to Bloomington and, bringing people here to look at Indiana as more than just one of the, kind of flyover states that people don't really think about when they think about food, then that'll be great if that's something that can happen.
about the process of the restaurant and how it's evolved and how many years you've been at this.
Well, November 7th of last year was 11 years. It's been a process. The first 3 years we were in a smaller location, a little bit off the beaten path. That's kind of where we cut our teeth and, started to grow up and try and figure this thing out. And then, we got the opportunity to move downtown Bloomington and, it's been a great, changed how everything happened and everything worked, the space was bigger, so we had to hire staff, and that took us a couple years before we finally were able to really get, the staff grown to the size that it needed to be and get the systems in place to actually make it work, not just kind of work us. I think the thing that happens with with most chefs is as they get older, when I was young, I wanted to, have these plates with all these components on it. And then as I've gotten older, I've refined my style and my technique's gotten a little sharper and I've been able to, get the same desired results with less, that whole less is more. And as you get older and you realize that, the most important components of a dish should be the things that are on the plate that really matter, and all the other stuff doesn't. If it doesn't contribute a major factor in the dish, then it really shouldn't be there.
Well, tell me a little bit about how your food has evolved over the years. If someone had been watching it very very closely, like you have all this time, what would they notice?
When we first opened, I was still cooking very classically, like French. Everything was still very, all the sauces were all French sauce. It was still very, my culinary school training was still very, fresh in my mind and still very, what I was into and what I was loving. And, the cookbook boom and craze and, exposure to Spanish chefs and these crazy Italian chefs and, the guys that are cooking the modern food and, all these chefs from the South that, is the food that I kind of, that my soul kind of, that kind of speaks to my soul, the collard greens and grits and, and finding out about Anson Mills and, all of these cool producers from all over, all over everywhere, the whole spectrum was blown wide open and you were able to, you didn't have to just cook this kind of food or that kind of food and, it could be, be whatever. I mean, my food's very, very influenced by, what we have here locally. But it's also, I love cooking Southern food. I love cooking fried chicken. I love making collard greens.
Do you now? Tell me a little bit about that.
There's just things that I love. There's just things that are close to my heart. It's always the death row meal thing, and mine is fried chicken is on my death row meal. Fried chicken would be, if my last day on earth, that's what I want to have. Good, bad, or otherwise. But, those are just the kind of things, that's just the kind of food that I love. It's what I love to cook a lot. But, I also like to cook really, really fancy, intricate things that, Greg and all those guys used to give me a hard time whenever we do dinners because I do these things that would be, each dish was a 3 to 4 to 5 pan pickup and they're just like, what's wrong with you? Why do you do this to yourself? From the simple to the most complicated, I just love it all. I love cooking. I love that this is what I get to do.
We've been talking with Chef David Talent of Restaurant Talent in Bloomington. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio for more on the chef's plans for the future, including cooking at the James Beard House in New York City. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Bloomington chef David Talent has seen plenty of changes to the Indiana dining scene in the 11 years since he opened Restaurant Talent. We talked recently about changes in fresh ingredients, where he finds inspiration, and about the dinner he'll be cooking with some local chefs at the James Beard House in New York City this summer. How would you describe your food?
I like to say it's new Midwestern, you know? I think that the Midwest is kind of, we're kind of like the melting pot of the melting pot, you know? Like, we've got people from everywhere and, you know, people from every country, people from every state, you know? We're just kind of like, we're kind of in the middle, and we're kind of one of those places where people, you know, people come here because it's nice to live here. It's nice to, I mean, people are nice. There's, you know, I don't think Hoosier Hospitality came out of nothing, but, you know, and so... You know, so we have all these influences from just around the country, but also from around the world, and so I think New Midwestern is, I think that's what I try and describe to people. You know,
have things gotten a little more casual over the years? You talked about you know the your food changing from the it's less classic maybe. So has the restaurant gotten less formal?
Oh, definitely. It definitely has. You know, when we opened, it was white tablecloths and, you know, cotton napkins. Now we have the cotton napkins and, you know, cool tabletops, but not, you know, no white tablecloths. And it's just, it's a lot less stuffy. It's a lot less, you know, there's still the formality in the way that the service runs, but it just doesn't feel as buttoned up as it maybe used to.
I think I've asked you this in the past about expansion plans and more restaurants and that sort of thing. Are you pretty much still just focused on this one location?
At this time, yeah. It's just one spot, and that's all we have. We're in the process of working on some. We're gonna do a few renovations and, you know, some freshening up of the restaurant, and coming up here in the next few months. And so, you know, we'll have a new kind of a new look to the decor. That, you know, like, we can change the decor and kind of, you know, maybe make things even a little more casual and there's some things that we're working on that because it's kind of time for us to do a freshen up and to make sure we stay current and with the times. And so, you know, we're excited about that. And you know, one's a lot of work. I can't imagine any more than one, really, ever.
Do you think it's a good time to be cooking in Indiana? Do you think that there's, maybe a little more excitement than we've seen in the past?
Yeah, we're definitely on the edge of the verge of, like, things to really, like, break open for us. I mean, you know, you got people like, you know, we have, like, Jonathan Brooks and Carlos Salazar. They're doing things that people in Indiana 20 years ago wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole. That now, you know, people are super jazzed about and, you know, very into. And I think it's great. I think it's fantastic. You know, that you know, people are more adventurous and more open and more, you know, willing to try things. You know.
Have you noticed that diners too are more willing to kind of come along and go with what a chef's vision might be?
To a certain extent,
yeah.
To a certain extent, you know, there's a group of for the most part a good group of people that are that way. You know, there's still some folks that are a little stuck in the mud, you know, and are taking a little bit more, you know, coaxing to get to that point. But I think as you know, people's trust grows, then it'll be, you know, I think it'll continue to grow, and people will continue to more and more will come along.
Anything that inspires you these days, you know, in trying to keep something fresh, you know, I understand it can be, challenging, to 10 years, to sort of, stay fresh in the business. What does inspire you, and what keeps you excited?
Honestly, the ingredients are the main thing, I have all, it seems like every year I get one or two, new, farmers or people that show up and they say, hey, look, I'm growing this. I have a guy that right now is doing they run a landscaping business, but he's been raising like vegetables and lettuce and things like that, aquaponically with the fish and everything. And so, he's bringing me these herbs, he's bringing me these basil leaves that are the size of your hand. These mammoth basil, and so we got a lot of that stuff during Italian month, and we were able to use a lot of this basil and this lime basil and opal basil and these lettuces, this lettuce that we have on the menu right now, this little kind of like baby romaine heads that are cool. So it's people like that, and then it's one of my other farmers who says he's going to drop me off a couple of catalogs to look at so that I can circle things that he'll grow for me, and he brings me 20 catalogs, and it's funny the conversation we had. He said, "So, he's like, is it going to cost me a lot of money?" I said, "Well, if you buy everything, every seed that that I circled, then it's probably going to break you. It's going to bankrupt you if you buy all the seeds that everything that I circled. If you buy them all, it's not going to be good for you." So it was kind of a joke. I said, you should never give me that many catalogs to look at. But so I have a couple farmers that will do that. Just give me catalogs and say, circle stuff and I'll try and grow it for you. So
now, has that changed in the last, 10 years? Is there more, available, more local stuff available?
There's a lot more that's available year round. The things that we could get in the wintertime, even 5 years ago. I mean, it's growing exponentially every winter. So it makes it a lot easier this time of the year than it used to be.
Right. So is it typically hard though to have such a focus on local regional products?
It makes it a little more difficult in the wintertime for sure. I mean, it absolutely does. But I mean, as if you're kind of sticking with seasonality and staying with the seasons, you have what you have to focus on, and you build off of that, and just the fact that you're able to get it maybe locally rather than have to have it shipped in from the produce company from California or from somewhere out west where it's warmer, or somewhere in Florida where it's warmer. But you can buy carrots here that are locally grown, you can buy sunchokes here that are locally grown, and some herbs that people are growing here locally. It's right now. Radish, watermelon radish, all kinds of different little flowers, and we're getting this really killer red vein sorrel from Annabelle's garden, and the stuff that they're doing is right now is like, I'm really loving that stuff. So
when you say you're inspired by ingredients, that's kind of where it starts, right? Seeing this stuff, and then is that how a dish develops? Or, do you start with an idea? Do you start with the ingredients? How does that go?
It's either or. I mean, I might see, I might see something in a cookbook that, I might see a dish and one component of that dish stands out. This is something Chrissy makes fun of me for. I have probably, 15 different notebooks that I write things that whichever one's closest is the one I'll grab, and I'll start. It doesn't even matter. I even have some that have the seasons named on them, but whichever one's closest, I'll just write down an idea. It might even be, the sea island red peas cooked like baked beans. I might write something down like that, and then, somewhere down the line, that, turns into maybe, lentils cooked like baked beans or, something like that in a dish. The dish will start to come around that way. Just, ideas from peers, and then, somebody shows up with something, or a new pork producer, pops in, somebody that's, got something different going on that, I have this available. If you want to try it out, tell me what you think, and you know, and then we just then it just kind of goes from there. And you know, I throw it to my sous chef Michael, and you know, we start to talk about it, and you know, he has ideas too, and so then we just start to you know, trade back the ideas, and then it just starts to come together that way, or kind of roll that direction.
So you're one of the chefs that are going to be going to New York this summer to do the beard dinner. So tell me a little bit about getting involved with that.
I don't know much. I mean, RJ just called me and said, hey, would you be interested in this? And I said, yeah, that'd be, you know, for sure. That would be awesome. And, you know, from that point on, he said, okay, I'll get back to you. And, you know, and then he said, okay, here's what we're doing. These are the dates that we have available. What do you think? And, you know, I told him what day I thought I would be great for me. And, you know, I was just like, whoa, you know, how is this, you know, how's this happening right now?
So it's kind of exciting, right? So you looking forward to it? I hear it's kind of challenging to cook there.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's, you know, like anything that we'll ever put ourselves through. You know, it's some of the most rewarding things that we do. You know, we, you know, walk through the fires of hell to do. It's just, I think it's just the way we're programmed. So, but I think it's awesome. I'm super excited and really looking forward to cooking with all these guys. And, you know, anytime we get to do things like that where, you know, we're helping each other plate dishes and things like that, it's just fun. It's like, you know, it's like playing on All-Stars in Little League or something, you know.
We've been talking with Chef David Talent of Restaurant Talent in Bloomington, Indiana. For more information on the chef and restaurant, go to restauranttalent.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. We've had a Bloomington-focused show this week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, as we've talked with two of Indiana's James Beard Award semifinalist chefs. Thanks to Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington, and thanks also to Chef David Talent of Restaurant Talent. We're looking forward to talking with two more James Beard Award semifinalist chefs next week, Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 and Chef Micah Frank of Black Market, both in Indianapolis. But for now, we'd like to say thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you E-Drink Indiana Radio.